This evening we're going to go further into the area that we're probing, which is the different energies that were created, particularly the energies, the male and female energies, and the polarity, the gender polarity, and the polarities between Hashem's world and our world, and how those energies operate with each other. What's important in the piece that we're going to be learning tonight, and possibly for the next week or two, is to appreciate the difference between male and female on the one hand, and male and female energy on the other hand. They're two different concepts. Now it so happens, the way God created the world, is that women generally are stronger in female energy than in male energy, and men are generally stronger in male energy than in female energy, or so it used to be until about 20 years ago. Now I don't know exactly what it is. But it's important to understand that there are these, that there's an energy, that masculinity and femininity, male and female, are energies, they're polarities, they're forces in the world. There's men and there's women, that's a different thing. Now, when we deal with things halakhically, we deal with men and women by definition. So there are ways to define a man, and it doesn't matter how masculine or effeminate he is. He still puts on fit. It doesn't make any difference. We deal in halakha, deals with definition. Every object in halakha, every object in the world, every idea has definition. And once you've defined what an object is, or what an idea is, or what a situation is, or what a relationship is, then the halakhot are applied. The art of psak, the art of learning halakha, is not to know what the halakhot are that apply. The art is to know what the definition is. Because once you know the definition, the halakhot automatically apply. There's no negotiation in that. If this person is a man, then the halakhot of a man apply to him. You don't have to be a Talmid Chacham to know what the halakhot of a man are. If this person is a Kohen, then the halakhot of a Kohen apply to him. If this person is a non-Jew, then the halakhot of a non-Jew apply to that person. If this is a dead body, and you've defined it as dead, then all the halakhot of a dead body apply. You don't have to be a big Talmid Chacham to know what those halakhot are. You have to be a Talmid Chacham to know whether the body is alive or dead. That has some difficult criteria. And so in all the areas of definition, what one really needs to learn in the area of halakha is how to define, how to give the right name to the right thing. Because when you start confusing the names, when you start confusing the terms, then everything else follows, and you get total confusion. So in halakha, for example, if we talk about issues of gender, there are only two genders. And it doesn't matter whether it's politically correct or not, there are not more than two genders. A person is either male or they're female. There is nothing else. Homosexual is not a gender. Homosexual is a behavior. It's not a gender. There wouldn't be a punishment for it in the Torah if it was a gender. And get punished for being a man or for being a woman. And yeah, you wouldn't get punished for being a homosexual if that was a gender. It's not a gender. It's a behavior. Transgender, that's nothing. That's fancy dress. That's dressing. That's costume. There's no such thing. There's male. There's female. How do you define a male? The way he's born. How do you define a female? The way she's born. If she wants to act like a man and she feels like a man, or he wants to act like a woman and she feels and he feels like a woman and he identifies with being a woman, good luck to him. But he's still a him. He's a him who acts like a her. That's what he is. You can keep it. Now, when you start giving him names, that's when you get into trouble. So now he's a transvestite, he's a cross-sexual, he's this, he's that. You start giving names, now you need halachot. So what bathroom does he go to, or she, or it? Now you've got a problem. Mm-hmm. The issue is around what names. If you give the right name, there's clarity. If you give the right term, there's clarity. And we can know what to do with it. I was learning a fascinating piece of Gemara just this morning on situations. I don't even know if they're real situations. It doesn't matter. The halakha deals with, sometimes it pushes the imagination, so as to test the halakha. Situations where a cow gives birth to an animal that looks more like a donkey than a cow. So is that a donkey or is it a cow? There are all sorts of differences. There are all sorts of issues. Issues around bechor. Is it a pet or chamor, which is one set of halachot? Or is it a Bechor Behema Tahara, which is another set of halacha? Is it kosher or isn't it kosher? The whole discussion is on how do you define the definition by the mother, the animal that gave birth to this being, or is it by the signs that the calf has got? Is it its own signs? Then how the issue is, how do you define, what name do you give? Mm-hmm. Once you've given the name, the halachot are easy. The art of thinking, the art of analysis, the art of strategy, the art of philosophy, almost every part of human endeavor rests on the accuracy with which we provide terms. And the names and the definitions that we give, because once the definitions are clear, everything else follows fairly naturally. So there's gender, there's male and female gender energy, and there's male and female gender people. So when the halakha operates, it doesn't operate with energies. So if a woman has a very masculine energy, there are women like that, as you know, she can't be the shliach tzibur for the shul. Because halakhically, she's a woman. That's just very simple. And we don't talk about the energies. If a man, I don't know what, wants to do something that only a woman can do, and he identifies as a woman, tough luck, you're a man. So the halachot that apply to you are the halachot on there. The man says, I feel like a kohen. I don't know what's going to happen when this happens. When rabbis are going to be confronted with this, it's imminent. It's going to happen. If it hasn't already, you watch, within a year or two. Somebody in the shul will come to the rabbi and say, Rabbi, I know I'm not a kohen, but I identify with it. Since I was a little child, I used to play kohen kohen. I used to put the toes over my head and I used to do it. I feel like a kohen. People were treating me like a kohen. I want the first aliyah. I'm a kohen. And you can't discriminate against me. That's the way I was born. I was born with a kohen tendency. We're going to have to say, sorry guys, see a shrink if you want, but you're not a kohen. There are ways to define, just as we've got to do with men and women. It's clear as anything. There's no discussion about it. And it's not a question of being dogmatic. Then we start getting labeled dogmatic, because we call things what they are. And yes, if that's dogmatic, in the area of definition, one needs to be dogmatic. Once you've defined, you can be as flexible as you want. But you've got to have clarity of definition. So we're going to deal tonight with two interesting things. One halakha and one practice. Two quite interesting things that seem to be unconnected, but they're not. The halakha that we're going to deal with is, as many of you have seen, and maybe there are even people in the room who are of Hasidic origin, and they wear a gavel. Anybody here wears a gavel when they daven? No, what's on it off?
Michael?
No, just my brother. Okay, so Hasidim put them before they daven. As you know, they put a belt on, a special belt around their... it's your family do that.
My father.
Your father wears a gavel. So the Hasidim wear before they daven, they put a silk kind of gavel, special belt that's made for that purpose, and they daven, and daven is over, they take it off. We don't do that, although the Shulchan Aruch says we should. The Hasidim are actually right. We're going to talk about why that is. What is the origin? Where does that actually come from? Who was the first Chosid that put on a gavel? We're going to have a look at it. And the second thing is, why... I'm going to word this politically correctly first, and then I'll word it politically incorrectly. The first word, politically correctly, is why should feminine energy not be utilized in psak halacha when you're making halachic decisions? We don't use feminine energy. If I say it non-politically correctly, I would say, why can women not be poskim? Why can women not make halachic decisions? And I know there are halachot, and there are all sorts of things that are happening today. Moshe. And some of them are positive. Sorry? We'll come to it. But the fact is, we'll see and we'll understand that you can't use feminine energy in the decision-making process, in the halachic decision-making process. And we'll understand why not. We'll also understand why only men wear gafels. Even among the women that wear gafels. Why when a woman does, why doesn't she put on a garter? Now there are anatomical reasons for that, as we'll see, but that's not the deep reason why this is something that applies specifically to men. So what's all this got to do with Adam and Eve? Let's have a look and see. So Hashem has told them not to eat from the tree of knowledge. And we discussed last week how Adam and Chava, the first couple, had only one flaw that made them human. Without that flaw, they would have been angelic forces. They would have been pure spiritual forces. What brought them down to earth and made them human was the fact that they had this tiniest little grain of gava, of ego. Tiny little grain of ego. Very, very little. But that's what made them human. And it was that grain of ego that caused them to favor a lifestyle that God advised them not to pursue. So God advises them to pursue a lifestyle of purity. They choose a lifestyle of greatness. And they're different. A lifestyle of purity, as we discussed last time, is a lifestyle that in which you avoid any spiritual risk. Because if you're dealing with spiritual risk, you're already, your mind is on the risk and on managing the risk, and you're not in the world of purity. You can only function in the world of purity where you're not even dealing with spiritual risk. Which is the reason that some communities, and one has to understand that without being judgmental, the reason that some communities prefer to be very closed. Now, you might argue today it's not really possible to be closed anymore, and what that is, because the global world comes right into your house. But in those homes, there aren't computers, and there aren't cell phones, and there aren't TVs, and there aren't newspapers. So they do their very best they can to insulate themselves, and we say they're isolated, they're insulated, they're disconnected. No, all they're trying to do is live the kind of life where they don't have to give a lot of thought to all the negativities of life. They don't have to spend time protecting themselves from the things we have to protect ourselves from if we want to stay in any way pure. And we have to try and protect our children from if we want to stay in any way pure. So they opt for a life of purity as far as is possible in this world, and they try and eliminate any risk to their spiritual purity. And that's the life that God actually recommended for Adam. Don't eat from the tree. Live this life of purity in the Garden of Eden where you don't have to deal with the things that could contaminate your purity, that could contaminate your spirituality. And it's so interesting. We get like quite narrow-minded when we talk about people who live these insulated lives. But in the health area, we understand it completely. We also don't like health risks. And we also get upset with contamination. And we also try and live in clean neighborhoods and clean areas. And if the air gets polluted, we get upset about that. So we know what it is. And if there's somebody sitting next to us on the plane who's sneezing away, we don't like it because it's infectious. But somehow we don't think that way spiritually. That the person sitting next to me in the plane could infect me spiritually. That the cell phone I'm opening could infect me spiritually. That the newspaper I'm reading could infect me spiritually. That the movie I'm watching could infect me spiritually. No, we don't worry about that. We're spiritually just fine. We're sound. No, we're spiritually much more fragile than we are physically. Our physical bodies were designed to withstand infection. Our souls weren't. They're not designed to stand. Our physical bodies are designed to withstand pollution. Our souls are not designed to withstand pollution. They don't have a mechanism for it. Even the world, and I'm not suggesting for a moment that we don't have to be careful with the planet and take care of it. And there is such a thing as Baal Tashrit. We're not allowed to destroy the world. But the world is designed to regenerate. It's designed to repurify. It's not as hopeless and as fragile as we sometimes make believe. It is fragile, but not as fragile. What is really fragile is the human spirit. What is really fragile is human dignity. That can be shattered in an instant, and it's very hard to recover. And the human spirit, the neshama, the soul, that can be polluted in an instant, and very, very hard to recover. But we don't mind about that. We're just worried about our physical health because we're so obsessed with our bodies and not with our souls. If we had half of the obsession with our souls as we do with our bodies, we would be in a very good position. So that's what Hashem suggested. Stay pure. Adam and Chava recognized that if they could crack the greatness challenge, it would be even more amazing. In other words, if they could experience challenge and they could experience distraction and overcome it, they could develop much greater strength than if they purely remained, if they remained pure. Moreover, if they could allow the world to deteriorate and then be active in elevating it and unveiling God from within nature, that would be greater than keeping them separate and keeping God in some other place and keeping it pure. And we talked last week, and this was Rav Dessler's idea 2 weeks ago, that it was that little particle of ego that made them, that attracted them to playing an active part rather than being passive. Purity is passive. Greatness is active. And you can't have them both. That was there. That was a polarity again that we discussed. You've got purity, you've got greatness, and you can move between them. But you can't be both. Purity, you can't engage in challenge. And greatness, you can't develop without challenge. So you've just got to decide which you're going to do. Are you going to go to the gym and really work those muscles out and challenge yourself and stretch yourself and become strong? Or are you just going to stay pure and not even expose yourself to that? And they were, because of that tiny speck of ego, they were attracted to being a little bit more active. And that's the piece that the snake says to them, and we discussed the metaphor of the snake and exactly what it means. And the snake says to them, which means they're saying to themselves in this inner conversation which is taking place, particularly in Chava's head, where the snake says, "Yitim kelokim," and you will become, God told you not to do it because he knows that if you eat from this tree, you will become like God. What does he mean, says Rashi, based on the Medrash? Yotzrei olamot, you will be able to create olamot, universes. And we talked about the word olam, that olam is translated as universe, yes, but olam comes from the word he'elem, which means hidden. The universe is a mysterious, hidden, black mass in which you can discover God. And that's what eating from the tree will enable you to create more mysterious black holes from which you can manifest Hashem. And Hashem knows that that's what you would be able to do. And then you would be like him. You would be good, divine. You would be godly. Is the conversation that goes on. But that appeals to the ego in Chava. When she hears that and says, is that so? And by eating this, we could actually create worlds of conflict, of gray area where things are not clear. And we could bring clarity. And we could demonstrate clarity. We can create a world that doesn't have kedusha, a world that doesn't have sanctity, and we can sanctify that world. That will be a much bigger kiddush Hashem than for us just to operate as the status quo and maintain and protect that status quo. Are we going to conserve or are we going to generate? Are we going to create or are we going to conserve? And that's the big choice. And the conversation that takes place in Chava, metaphorically between Chava and the snake, is that conversation. Am I going to remain a passive player that conserves the current state of purity of the world as high as that is? Or am I going to allow the world to evolve and develop and go through all its different phases and through my humanity manifest Kedusha and manifest Hashem within that and thereby make Hashem's name even greater than it would have been before? That's what's going on in her mind.
What verse?
The verse we're on now is chapter 3, verse 6.
6.
Yeah, 5. And then we're told about Tere HaElisha, and Rashi says, Ra'ata Devarav Shel Nachash. She saw the words of the Nachash. So in this conversation, she hears the other side, and it makes sense to her. So, V'han'ula, it sat comfortably, it sounded right. So here we start the beginning of the use of the feminine energy in Psach Halacha. Sounds right. Intuitively, this feels right. Nothing wrong with it. We've got intuition. When we're unsure of ourselves, intuition is one of the ways we can guide ourselves. So Chava is accessing her intuition, and intuitively, eating from the tree doesn't seem to be a bad idea. She's got a halachic problem. What's a halachic problem? Yeah, God said no. That's a halachic problem. So we'll see how she'll deal with that. She's brilliant. You'll see, as a halachic authority, she's totally brilliant. She just made an error. And kitovais, the tree is actually good, says Rashi. What could be wrong with becoming more godly? What has the snake just said to me? If we eat from the tree, we're going to become more divine. We're instructed to be like God. We're instructed to emulate Hashem. We've got to emulate Hashem. And the snake has just told me he's right. God said it himself. If you eat from the tree, you're going to become wiser. You're going to become more effective. You're going to become more divine in what you do. What could possibly be wrong with that? And it's beautiful to look at. But it doesn't mean just beautiful to look at, says Rashi. She's not going to eat from the. She's not going to eat treif because it looks good. This is Chava we're dealing with, the greatest woman who's ever lived. So what is it? The tree is treif, but it looks nice, so let me have some. No, says Rashi. When it says ta'avahu le'enayim, it's something that the eye craves for. It's because your insight is magnified when you eat from this tree. It's not sight, it's insight. You see things with clarity. You see things differently. Like we were complaining a few minutes ago, how as we get older, we don't see with quite the same levels of clarity. But that inner eye, the insights we have, are much more clear. We see the world with our ears. Maybe if the lights are dim, we can't read small print as easily as we used to be able to. But our insights, those are much more developed as we get older and we get more experience. And this would be a fast track to insight. Says Chava, what's wrong with that? So I can get insight, I can be more divine. The nechmada etzla skill, and it's wonderful for seichel. Kamo she'amala, yodei tov v'ra, you'll understand. Tov v'ra, good and bad, you'll understand morality, you'll understand everything that goes with that, levels of understanding. So as she reasons it out, she realizes the properties that this fruit would imbue in her and her husband are all the most desirable properties. She's not, doesn't say it will make you wealthy. She's not after the money. It's not because it tastes good. She's not after the good meal. These are all higher things she's craving for. As she hears these things and thinks of these things, they become a yearning, something she desperately wants. It's available, it's there for the taking. Okay, God said, no, we'll deal with that still. One thing she knows for sure is she is chalashim for it. So we have to understand, we've got to kind of transpose how you would feel. Just imagine the food that you find, you know, the most mouth-watering food in the world. And after a Yom Kippur, at the end of a Yom Kippur, how you might be craving that particular food. And we've got to understand that her craving was much greater, but it wasn't a craving for anything physical. It was a craving for greatness. She sees the opportunity for greatness. She sees the possibility for greatness. And in her purity, she understands what she could do with that greatness. What she could do for Hashem. What she could do in the building of her family. What she could do in the establishment of humanity. It's a no-brainer for her that this is something she must have. We're going to learn two pieces of Vilna Gaon. The first one is an analysis of just this piece that we've just read. And the Vilna Gaon says the following. And I like reading the text inside when we're analyzing something deeply, because every word is important, and that you hear it from its source. Mipnei shekol tovot ha'olam nechelakim l'shlosha. The Vilna Gaon uses a word here which we often avoid. The ultimate of generalization, the word all. So we're kind of careful to say mostly and often and frequently, because all is a word people take offense at. How do you know? Or maybe there's an exception. But Vilna Gaon's not particularly worried about that. And he says, because all the good things in the world can be categorized into three categories. That's it. One is called Tov, inherently good, morally good, essentially good. That's one kind of goodness. The other is Arev. It's tasty. It's attractive. It's pleasant. It's comfortable. It's pleasing. That's the second kind of good. And the third one is more ill. It's useful. It is effective. It is helpful. It's useful. So when we say something's good, you've got to question yourself or one another if you're in a conversation. What do you mean by good? Do you mean delicious? Do you mean morally good? Or do you mean useful? It's one of the three. That's what you must mean by the word good. V'asiman, and this is implied in a verse in Tehillim, which we say in the davening, ta'amu uru'u ki tov Hashem. Taste and see that Hashem is good. And the siman is ta'amu, if you break that word up, the tet stands for tov, the ayin stands for arev, and the mem vav is mo'il, ta'amu. So in accessing Hashem, you'll get all three. Hashem is essentially good, Hashem is attractive and pleasant, and Hashem has good use. Hashem is effective. And then you'll understand what Tov is. If you understand the goodness of Hashem, where these three dimensions all integrate into one aspect of goodness, then you'll know what real goodness is. Real goodness is when you've got all three. When something is inherently good, and it's incredibly attractive, and it's effective, it's useful, it has a good use. We've got all three, that's amazingly powerful. Ki me'Hashem yitbarach yagia lanu kol shlosha elu, because in our relationship with Hashem, we can access all of these three dimensions. Va'achar she'shama'a ha'isha divrei ha'nachash, when the woman listened the argument of the nachash, hitchila le'ayen b'davar. Now le'ayen b'davar is an important word, especially when used by the Vilna Gaon. So you'll find that the word is used in many different areas, but perhaps nowadays one of the most familiar areas is if you're in yeshiva, or you're talking to somebody who's studying in yeshiva, they will talk about two types of learning. You can learn bikiyut, which means you turn pages, you cover ground. You learn fairly superficially, but fast. Daf yomi is bikiyut, a page a day. A page, if you're going to learn it bi'iyun, which means really analyze it deeply, a page of Gemara, if you're learning the entire day, from morning till night, a page of Gemara will take 2 to 3 days, if you're lucky, if you're really bright and really fast and you're fluent in Aramaic and Hebrew, you're going to learn a page of Gemara maybe in 3 days. In the fast yeshivas, we used to do 2 pages a week in terms of Iyun. And that's 24 hours a day on that Gemara, 2 pages a week. Bikiyut, people learn a page a day. So there are two types of learning. There's learn be. So when the Vilna Gaon says, what does she mean? What does he mean? She started studying this tree Be'iyun. She started studying the law that Hashem had given her. Be'iyun. She started really going into halachic depth as to what this was all about. Zeu Shama. So when she starts off and she says, Vatere kitov ha'etz l'machal be'etzem hatov. She notices that leaving aside attractive and useful, it's inherently good. This tree stands for good things. It's not a bad tree. It's not poison. There's nothing negative about it. It does good things. It's a good drug. It has a good effect on people who eat it. V'chitavahu le'naim hu arev ashiyitaveh adam b'kol avat nafsho. And it's also incredibly attractive that it creates a yearning and a craving. Ki lo chen el hamo'il o el atov. Not everything that is essentially good creates craving. Not everything that is useful and practical creates a craving. But this tree is essentially good, and there's a craving. You have to have it. Once you kind of, you've just got to have it. You've got to feel the force in her. Almost an addictive force, although there's nothing, she's not addicted because she's never had it. But it's that kind of need. V'nechmada it's la skill. And in addition to that, it happens to be really useful. It's a great tool. So it's got all the, it's got everything, it fits into the phrase of Ta'amu u'ru'u ki tov Hashem. When all three dimensions of goodness integrate into one object, that is superb. What can be better than that? Ki achemdahu el davar ruchani, when it says nechmad ha'etz la'askil, says the Vilna Gaon, the word chemda, nechmad, is a higher attraction. It's not arev, is just a physical attraction. Tasty, delicious, wanted, crave for it. But nechmad is a higher, is a spiritual attraction, an intellectual attraction. Or la'askala shi'agiyem bimeno akavod. And sometimes when it's used negatively, it's to gain honor, but it's to gain honor from wisdom, not to gain honor from something lower down. So that's, she studies the tree and she comes to this conclusion that this tree is good in every dimension of goodness. There isn't one single area in which it isn't good. So now, what about the law? God said, don't eat it. What's she going to do with that? So where do you go to? Where does one go to when you start and you say, it just doesn't make sense. This is so good in every way. God said, don't eat it. It doesn't make sense. So what do you then start doing? Maybe we didn't understand it properly. Maybe that's not what it meant. So now, having studied the tree, when you study halakha, you have to study two parts. You have to study the object, and you have to study the law. So if you're learning the halakha of shechita, how to slaughter an animal, you've got to understand an ox and a cow and a lamb, you've got to understand the anatomy and the physiology, and you've got to understand the laws. And you've got to understand what the steel of a knife is, the metal of a knife. You've got to understand the object, and you have to understand the halakha. So she studied the object, she studied the tree. Now she starts applying her genius mind to the halakha. And the Vilna Gaon says, this piece that I'm learning with you now, we don't have it in writing from the Vilna Gaon, but what we have in writing is a piece by a man called Reb Pesach Frankl, who lived in Hungary during the time of the Chassam Sofer, which was a couple of centuries ago. And he writes that he heard this from a Talmid Chochem from Vilna, who was close to the Vilna Gaon, who said that this was how the Vilna Gaon taught this piece. So it's second hand, but it's a reliable second hand. So he says, Chazal said there are different views as to what this tree was actually. And the leading view is that it was an etrog tree. Is what it was. What's unique about an etrog tree is that Eitzor Pirio Shave, an etrog tree, is the only tree whose bark tastes like the fruit. Vashem Yitbarach lo amar rak ume Eitz Hadad lo tochal. Hashem did not say in the original instruction, you may not eat the fruit. He said, you may not eat the tree. Or may Eitz from the tree. Va'ad ata lo yad ashi yesh be'Eitz ha'ilam tam tree. Until this point, Chava did not know, how could she have known, that the wood of the tree, the bark of the tree, tasted like fruit. She didn't know that. This was just a tree like any other tree. Alken Masha Amara Kodesh Baruch Hu Me'etz Hainu Pri. So if this is an ordinary tree, forget that the tree tastes like fruit, and I just say to you, don't eat from this tree. And you say to your kid, don't eat from this tree. And the kid picks the fruit and eats. And you say, I just told you, don't eat from the tree. And the kid says, no, you didn't say I mustn't eat the fruit. You said I mustn't eat from the tree. I didn't touch it. I didn't eat from the tree. That's not very bright. So she understands if God says don't eat from the tree, he means don't eat from the fruit. She gets that. That's what she has thought up to this minute. Avakeshivina, but now she starts studying the tree. And she smells the tree. She touches the tree. And hevina sheyesh la'etz tam pri. She notices the wood tastes like fruit. It has the smell of the fruit. And maybe she even took a bite of it to see what it tasted like, and it tasted like fruit. Hetira la'atzma ha'pri, she realized the fruit is actually okay. When God said, don't eat from the tree, he meant what he said, literally. Don't eat from the tree. Otherwise, he would have said from the fruit. Do you follow the difference? In other words, if this tree was an ordinary tree, then you don't have to explain yourself. When you say don't eat from the tree, it means the fruit. But if the tree itself is edible and tastes good, and you say don't eat from the tree, that might mean don't eat from the tree, eat from the fruit. That's what it might mean. And then she says, "De lo asar Kadosh Baruch Hu elo ha'etz v'lo ha'pri." Ah, she says, God never said the fruit; He said the tree. V'zer she'amar ha'katuv v'atera isha ki tov ha'etz l'machal. That's why it says here, the woman saw that the etz is good to eat. And then what did she eat? V'tikach mipirio. She saw, look how brilliant the Vilna Gaon is, just in the understanding of the words. It says she saw the tree was good to eat, so she ate the fruit. If she saw the tree was good to eat the tree. If she ate the fruit, she should have said she saw the fruit was good to eat, and she ate it. But it doesn't say that. It says she saw the tree was good to eat, so she ate the fruit. Says the Vilna Gaon, because now she realizes she had misunderstood the halakha. She thought the halakha was that you can't eat the fruit. Now she realizes the halakha is you can't eat the tree. But the fruit you can. Vatikach mipiryo vatachal. And so she took from the tree and she ate. So that's quite brilliant halakhic reasoning. She's now dealt with the halakha as well. So she starts off, this tree is the most amazing tree. It has good qualities. It does good things for people who eat it. It's beautiful. It's good for insight. It's causes sanctity, it enables growth, it brings about greatness, all sort of amazing things.
So she took from the tree or the fruit to eat?
She took from the fruit.
Ah, from the fruit, not the tree.
No, she took from the fruit. She saw the tree was good to eat and she took from the fruit, is what the Torah says. So she figures out the tree is amazing. Now she's got this problem, but God said don't eat it. But that doesn't make sense. Why would God forbid the eating of something so amazing? So she starts figuring. So what has she done wrong? Where's her error? And her reasoning is right. If she's making halakha, she's got nobody to ask. Adam's not there. She's got nobody to ask. Where's the error? What has she done wrong?
She's rational.
The error is not in any piece of what of the process. The error is in the process itself. The error is that she starts with intuition and she moves into halakha. And that's the feminine energy. That is a feminine way, without a judgment, because there are parts where that is the best way to reason. And that's why we're told that the woman has bina yetera. There are areas in which she can intuit things that a man will never get. Because the masculine energy is you start with data, and then you get to intuition. And that's why men will always ask, what's the data? Give me the analysis. Where are the spreadsheets? And the woman won't get it. Can't you just see that this is a good investment? Do you actually need spreadsheets for it? So let's look at this. Let's look at the historics and let's look at the balance sheets. You don't need the balance sheets. These are good people. They're running a good business. They're onto a good idea. Well, how much profit have they made? Who cares how much profit they make? They will make profit. How do you know they'll make profit? Being like you say, I know. So it's a powerful force that again, I'm saying a woman, but I'm talking about this feminine energy, which generally women excel at. Not always, but generally. And generally, men are not that good at it. Men are better at the male energy. They meet up in the middle. But the question is, what is the direction? What is the dynamic? Do you go from data to intuition, or do you go from intuition to data? And Chava went, as a woman, from intuition to data analysis. And then the problem is, your data analysis is clouded by your intuition. Mm-hmm. So unless your intuition is 100% accurate, you run the risk of distorting the data, because we all know what you can do with data. Mm-hmm. So unless you're willing to go to the data, in halakha is the data. What Hashem told us, the body of information that Hashem gave us is halakha. That is the data. Unless your intuition is so sharp and accurate, the chances of going from intuition, you need to use intuition. You can't learn without intuition. But you start with data and you emerge with intuition and then you check alignment. You don't start with intuition and then look at data and check alignment. So where was the mistake? What was wrong with her intuition? Wasn't her intuition right? She analyzed the tree and she said, this is the most amazing tree. Why would Hashem forbid it? She's missing one piece of information that she's missing, because she just hasn't had the experience yet. And that is, it's feasible that Hashem created this amazing tree that could, in fact, bestow upon humanity all these incredible properties in order to make it desirable for her. Because nothing else would have been desirable. If the tree was just delicious, if it was sugar-coated, if it was, that wouldn't make a difference to her. Not going to be a big deal. So there's nothing else. The only way he could make it attractive to Chava is to make it spiritually, intellectually, and physically attractive. Attractive in every way. But most important, spiritually. Most important, that this is a fruit that can create greatness. This is a fruit that can make you great. That makes it so, it makes for her a yearning and a craving like nothing else could be. Now why would God do that to her? Just to create struggle. That's the only struggle that existed in the Garden of Eden. That's why there's only one mitzvah. The only struggle you've got is resist the temptation of greatness in favor of purity. That's all I'm asking you to do. Yes, it's a huge temptation. You're right. God would be saying to Chava. And this is an amazing tree. And it does make human beings great. But not eating from the tree because I told you not to connects you to me in a way that nothing else can. And that's why the Lota says the negative mitzvot of the Torah are more important in so many ways than the positive ones. They connect us to God more. Because the positive mitzvah, you're only fulfilling at the moment you're fulfilling the mitzvah. And that's fine, that's great, and that's good. Positive mitzvahs are wonderful. But a negative mitzvah, not to do something, that's all the time. All the time you're saying to yourself, I can't talk Russian home. I can't eat toast. I can't have this glass of wine. I can't go to that meeting on Shabbos. I can't travel on this tour because it's on Shabbos. I can't, and why not? Why not? Why not? Because I'm connected to Hashem. And that would break my connection. That's faithfulness to Hashem. That's like a couple being faithful. So a man being faithful, a woman being faithful. I'm thinking, yeah, there's a beautiful girl over there. I can't, because that would break my connection with my wife. Mm-hmm. Not going to happen. And that way he's connected to his wife even when he's a million miles away. That keeps the connection. Mm-hmm. The faithfulness is the lot, I say. So God says, I've got to give you one negative mitzvah. I've got to give you one mitzvah not to do. I'm just going to give you one. But as long as you hold, and it's going to be incredibly attractive to you. Not because it's sugar-coated, but because of the greatness. Mm-hmm. And you are the kind of person, Chava and Adam, who will be yearning for greatness. I know that. It's going to be a hard mitzvah to keep, but it's only one. And by staying away from the tree, because I told you to, you're staying connected to me. That's faithfulness. Mm-hmm. That she didn't work out. But you're right. This tree is great. And God put it there. But he put it there not to be eaten from. He put it there to be resisted. And the Orach Chaim brings a beautiful Zohar in Parshas Truma, where a king instructs his son is growing up, becoming a teenager, and he says, keep away from prostitutes, they're dangerous, don't go anywhere near them. And then he hires a prostitute and says, tempt my son with all you've got, because he wants the struggle, and he wants to be able to watch and train the child and see the child, and he wants the child to be able to say, you're an attractive woman and I would love to go to sleep with you, but my father said I can't, and I'm connected to my father. And if I did that, it would break that connection. That's what the king wants to hear. And that's what Hashem wants to hear from us each time we have the opportunity to do something he's told us not to do. And we only needed one thing. That would have been enough faithfulness. Same as a man only needs one wife, a wife only needs one husband. That can create faithfulness. We only needed one mitzvah. She couldn't work out why God would make something so magnificent and say you can't have it. Not realizing that in the not having it is the most delicious part of the whole concept. And she missed that. And what caused her to miss that? That little grain of ego with which she's created that says, I want to be active. I want greatness rather than purity. And that's why she makes that choice. I want to do just this one piece further, and then we'll end it for tonight. So what happens? She eats from the tree. She gives to her husband, and we'll analyze that more probably next time. But notice, "Vatiten gam leisha ima," and she gave it to her husband, ima, which the Ora Chaim says means when they were intimate together. That's when she did it. And we'll talk about the relevance of that. Vayochal and he ate. So we're going to have to go to the whole question, did he know what he was eating? Did she tell him? Did he think it was an ordinary fruit? What was that all about? What was his role in that? And he must have been some way involved because Hashem punishes him. So he's accountable for something. So we'll analyze that a bit next time, and also we'll be getting into the consequences. But what I want to look at now, in order to demonstrate the point that I guess, the first thing I asked you was, why should you not use feminine energy in Pesach Halacha? So I think you understand that. Because if a woman were to think, reason halakhically, putting data before intuition, she would be compromising her femininity. It's not a feminine thing to do. It's not a feminine thing to say, leave intuition, leave just leave feelings aside here. What are the facts? A woman can do it, she can be very good at it. There's nothing, not a question, she doesn't have the capacity to do it. Of course she does. She's as good as any man. A woman has a brain as good as any man, and she's got intuition, she's got everything it takes to be better than a man and what men do. That's not the issue. The issue is at what cost? Does she lose femininity when she does that, or does she enhance femininity? When a woman enhances her femininity when she uses her feminine energy, which is from intuition to data. And yes, sometimes she'll get to the data and there'll be a disconnect, as with a man, and she'll have to manage the disconnect. But the direction is, it starts from our heart. I can feel what's right and what's wrong. Now let me just check the data and see what's going on here. With a man, I have no clue what's right and what's wrong. Let me have a look at the data. Perhaps I'll figure this out. And as he gets involved in the data, he starts getting an intuitive thought, if he is good at that. If sometimes men don't, they stick in the data and they can't get out of the data. But if he's a complete human being, he'll move from the data and he'll study the data deeply, and as he gets better and better, more and more involved in the data, it's like Gary Player, the golfer, said, the thing, strange how luck follows the people who work hardest. People said, you seem to have a lot of luck in your golf. And he said, yeah, the people who practice most have the most luck. Strange thing. But he wasn't just saying it's not luck, it's practice. What he's saying is when you practice like crazy, you develop the luck. You develop that intuition, say, practicing music. You can start playing intuitively if you've learned your scales and you've played the piece a million times. Then you can let go a little bit and you can become intuitive. That's the male energy. So that's why in Pesach Halacha it's a dangerous thing to use. Now many people today use feminine energy in halakhic discussion. And particularly when you have lay halakhic discussions taking place at Shabbos tables and things like that, everybody's passing their opinion on what should be and what shouldn't be and what the rabbi should be saying. Shouldn't be, everyone's got an opinion. But where does that come from? It doesn't come from deep knowledge of Shas. It's no data. It's like somebody passing an opinion on business or on what kind of heart operation Dr. Geth should do, when you've got no clue, you've never seen a heart, you've never studied anatomy. But I've got a strong feeling, Dr. Geth, I think this is what it is probably. You'd be laughed out of the house, but when it comes to Torah, doesn't matter. Everybody has got a strong intuition, a strong feeling of what's right and what's wrong. That's feminine. You're entitled to that feeling. We do all have our feelings about what's right and wrong, but we can't decide halakha that way. We have to come at it from the... It has to be intuitively right. You've got to align your intuition, but you come at it through the data and you emerge with the intuition. She did it the other way around. The last thing was this question about the gautel. So what happens then? Vatipakatna ineshnehem. Their insight just sparks. They eat from this tree, and it's not so much the eating of the tree, it's the disobeying God. They've now asserted their independence, they've disobeyed God, and with that comes grace. So now they're independent. God has given them that choice. God has empowered them to disobey him. God gave them that right and said, here it is, here's the world, here's the tree. Make your own choices. And they did. And by doing so, they become great. Their eyes open. They knew they were naked. And Chazal asked him, everybody, you have to become so brilliant to know you're naked? You've got to eat from the Itz Hadat, otherwise you know that you're naked. What does that mean? We'll see. And what did they do then? Vayitpuru aleta ena, and they sewed together fig leaves. Vayasu chagorot. Vayasu lahim chagorot. And they made for themselves, how do you translate chagorot?
Like
Belts. Sorry?
Belts.
Belts is the right translation. Mm-hmm. Belts. Mm-hmm. Not loincloths. Belts. Now, what does a belt help if you're naked? Not a whole lot. But it explains why further on, when God says, why did you hide away? What did they say? They say we were afraid because we were naked. But you weren't naked already. You made yourself loincloths, if that's how you want to translate. So clearly they were still naked after they made the fig leaves. The fig leaves didn't cover up their nakedness. It was just a belt. It was the first garment. They realized they needed a garment. That was the first, that was the origin of that law, which is passed in Shukarok, and Simon Tzadi, or somewhere around the beginning of it, was Tula, that you've got to wear a belt when you're done. Now, there are two reasons for it. The one reason is, shelo yeheli boro et ha'erva, that there is a separation between the upper part of your body and the lower part of your body. That's one reason. Mm. And the second reason is, and therefore that Shukarok says, if you have a natural belt, then, or you've got elastic around your pants or whatever, then you don't need it. That separates the top part from the bottom part of the body. But in the days where they used to wear these long gowns and tunics, you had to tie something around your waist so that top part of your body and the bottom part of your body were not in the same area of clothing. And the other reason is because of Kol Lekras Elokei Kol Yisrael, where the Gemara talks about the fact that you've got to make a preparation to meet Hashem. When you stand, when you're going to be done with Shmoneh Esrei, you're standing before Hashem, you don't just walk in and stand. You do something to demonstrate that you've stopped what you were doing and you're now starting to do something else. You're standing in Kadoshim. Come on, prepare yourself. Just have a moment of preparation. And the Gemara says different Amorai and different authorities used to do different things. One of them was put a belt on, that she says in the Gemara, as an act of Hikomikrata. Just take a moment to put a belt on, especially if you think about the fact that I'm going to stand before God. And others are washing their hands, which is what we do. So we wash our hands before davening, not because our hands are dirty, not because we like our Motsi, just to make a break between what was and what's going to be. The same reasons we wash our hands before we bench. Mayim Achronim, yes, there are all sorts of other reasons as well, but there's a simple reason to create that. You've been eating, eating's over, prepare yourself to meet Hashem in conversation, which is what you're doing in the benching. And so with the Shmoneh Esrei. That's where it comes from, but why don't women do it? So the way the reason I said is anatomical, the way women are constructed, that separation of top and body part and part of the body isn't as important. But there's something much more important going on. We say a brocha every morning. Ozer Yisrael Bigvura. Ozer Yisrael Bigvura means he girds the Jewish people with power. It's a brocha for power. We have power. When do you make that brocha? Now today we just make all those brochas in one go, but those brochas used to each be made when you did an action of getting up in the morning. So when you got out of bed and you stood on the ground, you said, Rokah ha'aretz al ha'mayim, you thank God for creating firm ground on which you can stand. And Shasali kol tzoki when you put your shoes on. And Otei Yisrael v'tifara when you put your hat on. Ozer Yisrael b'gvura is when you put your belt on. That's when you make that. Now interestingly, the Unculus translates the Chagura, in this case by Yas Lahem by Yasu Lahem Chagurot. Unculus translates it in the Aramaic by Avdin Lohon Zerazin. Zerazin means belts, but Zerazin also means strength. So Oteris Rabbi Vura, the brocha we make when we put on the belt is about strength. Unculus uses a word here for chagura, and the word he uses has an intonation of strength as well as belt. The Targum Yonasan uses the word kimurin, which also means belt, and it means a belt that is used for aesthetically. So in the Gemara it says in Gemara Shabbos that a woman is allowed to wear a komara on Shabbos. A komara is a decorative belt. Is that an item of clothing? No, it isn't, but it's attached. It's decorative. And therefore, she's allowed to wear it outside in the street on Shabbos, even if there's no Eruv. So both Targum Yonasan and Targum Unculus make it very clear that what they made was a useless piece of clothing. It didn't cover their nakedness, because later on they say, we knew you were naked, so we hid away. Didn't cover their nakedness, didn't keep them warm, didn't keep their pants up because they weren't wearing pants. It had no function. It was aesthetic. Why at this point do they do it? And why when they're Aramim? What is that about? And why do we say the brach of strength? Why is there strength in that? strength, when we talk about Jewish strength, it's the strength of being able to think with masculine energy. That's the strength. So men are associated with more strength than women. That's not what, again, not that women can't be strong. They can develop their muscles like a man, and they can be strong, and they can pick up all sorts of big things. They can be wonderful. But it doesn't enhance their femininity. With a man, the stronger he is, the more it enhances his masculinity. Because strength is a masculine energy. Tzniut is a feminine energy. Attractiveness is a feminine energy. Strength is a masculine energy. There are women who will be attracted to brutish, ugly men who are very strong and powerful. Whether the power is in their wealth, or their political position, or their physical strength, it's often attractive. Not so with a man. He's not necessarily attractive to her. Strong, I like her because she's got muscles. Wow. That's not the feminine energy. So when we talk about strength, we're talking about in the Torah world, when we talk about, we're not talking about physical strength. That's not a Jewish quality. We're not that good at strength. We don't win a lot at the Olympics. We're not the fastest runners, and we're not the biggest weightlifters. That's not our strength. Our strength is we can separate the top from the bottom. The bottom is sensuality. We can use sensuality. Hashem gave it to us. It's very important. But not when we're making halakhic decisions. When we're making halakhic decisions, we've got to be able to pull them apart and use heart and head in that process and bring sensuality in afterwards. That's the masculine way of reasoning. And Adam and Chava realize what's just happened. Mm-hmm. They've just acted using feminine energy for a halakhic situation, and they've caused havoc as a result of it. So the first thing they do in tikkun, the first way they rectify, is to get to the source of what went wrong. The source of what went wrong is they went from intuition to data and not the other way around. And so the first thing they do is the chagura. We've got to remember that when it comes to halakhic reasoning, top and bottom operate differently. Heart and mind are aligned. Gut and instinct, that's part of our defensive mechanism. That keeps out of halakhic reasoning. What's above the waist is part of, it includes emotion, it's not about not being emotional, about not being social, but it's that alignment of heart and mind that guides halakhic decision making, and not some of the other issues that come in. And so that's what they did. We have to understand at this point, they both were in gavels. Isn't that right?
Yeah.
When did that change? When was it no longer necessary for Chava to wear a gavel? At this point, they're the same. Man and woman are there. Both use feminine. They're very, very similar at this point. So the changes start as a consequence. When God gives each of them their consequence, that's when we really start to see gender polarity. When God actually defines man and defines woman and defines the snake, we learn about these three energies. The energy of the mind, the energy of the heart and intuition, and the energy of sensuality, and what their roles are and how they operate together. So we'll leave that there for tonight, and I believe I'm here for the next two Wednesday nights. So let's plan, we'll confirm in the email, but let's plan on the next two Wednesday nights together again and continue discussing. So yes, 8 o'clock.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.